Welcome to Hot Flashes and Cool Topics podcast, the voice for women in midlife and beyond. At Hot Flashes and Cool Topics, we talk about anything and everything to do with midlife. My name is Colleen.
My name is Bridget.
And today we are going to tell you a story that will be familiar for a lot of women, and that's issues with our healthcare system for women's health. And today we have on Deborah Kopaykin. She is a photojournalist and author of Lady Parts, and she was also author of Shutter Babe and a successful writer. She's been on Emily in Paris as far as writing for them. So in picture perfect world, she is a very successful author. But when it came to her health, she nearly died because the healthcare system either one could not diagnose properly what she was going through, or she simply didn't have coverage and couldn't afford a $40,000 surgery. So I think it's a story that resonates with a lot of women in this country, unfortunately. And it's something that needs to be addressed in our healthcare system overall. But with Deborah, she's going to share her stories from Lady Parts, which is the last book that she wrote. And, you know, it's an issue that really hits home with Bridget and I because we talk to so many women who simply cannot get proper healthcare in this country.
It is just so frustrating to see someone that is on the brink of financial ruin, that is a very well-educated person, that is a successful writer, that is a success in her career, yet these things are happening to them. And these happen to so many women. Things like divorce, things, lifestyle changes, job losses, things like that, and how that can ruin you financially. Not only that, but how in our healthcare system, she is dismissed. She is not listened to. She is waiting for hours in emergency rooms to get care. Just the things that she is going through. She is being fired from jobs because she's not getting proper healthcare. And it is so frustrating. And this isn't the first time we've heard about this story in a woman in our demographics age. I just can't believe the number of people that go bankrupt or lose a home or lose just their whatever their savings.
Or lose their hearing, which
that's
going
she
to
had,
tell you.
Yeah, that happens to her. You'll find out about that in this episode. You know, we're really thrilled to have her on. And don't forget, you can catch Hot Flashes and Cold Topics videos on YouTube. If you want to watch the video of our conversation, you can catch us on Instagram, on Facebook. We have a great Facebook group where women are helping each other out with important questions. And also, if you are in the New York area on April 27th, make sure that you check out Conversations with Prime Women. Colleen and Mindy Cohn are going to be hosting this. And if you're there, you need to check it out. I'm really going to try to be there in New York to see it too.
Fingers
they have
crossed.
Fabulous guests. Yes, they have some fabulous guests on, and you really want to check that out. So if you're in the area, check out conversationswithprimewomen.com for tickets.
Thank you for that plug, Bridget. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
As Bridget said, Conversations with Prime Women, we have Laura Geller coming. We have Fern Malice. We have Dolores Catania from The Real Housewives of New Jersey. So, you know, if you're local, you know you want to see that. And again, this story that we're going to tell with Deborah is all too common for women. And yet, I just want to share real quick. She's going to tell you the story of the New York Times reviewing her book and writing a negative review simply because she told the truth about literally hemorrhaging in her house. And they found that to be distasteful for the reader. And I find that to be offensive to anyone
right.
who's experienced
yeah.
it. So yeah. We're going to talk to Deborah and we will check with you after.
Welcome back to Hot Flashes and Cool Topics, everybody. I am really thrilled today to have Deborah Kopaykin on. Welcome to the show, Deborah.
Thank you so much, you guys. It's really nice to meet you.
You know, your book, it really touches on the struggles that people, and particularly women who are well-educated, have, you know, publicly successful, you know, with writing books, TV writing, that are on the brink financially because of circumstances. And people don't realize that. Do you mind sharing a little bit about how this happened to you and how it is not uncommon?
Sure. I mean, I think we actually have to go back. If I were to revert back in time, I think it starts with the birth of a child. And the birth of a child, I don't know what it costs in Tennessee, where you guys are, but in New York City, back in 1995, it was $9,000. That's out of pocket. That's not covered by insurance. So I had two kids, $9,000 each in rapid succession. That's $18,000. I didn't even think that that was something that I was going to have to pay, right? Then you're talking about the cost of childcare, which we have not addressed in this country. Then fast forward several years, and I have several serious illnesses. One of them is called adenomyosis, which is a lot like endometriosis. It went undiagnosed for 16 years until it was incredibly far along, and my uterus had to come out. By that point, I'd had another child, and I think in 2006, the cost of a child was $10,000, $11,000 at the hospital, right? So you're talking about great sums, five-figure sums of money just to have a baby, a healthy baby. My babies were okay. They didn't have to go into the neonatal department or anything like that. So add on the cost of a major medical operation, the removal of a uterus. Add on the cost of childcare. Add on the cost of college tuitions, which I was paying two of them at once, and then add a divorce in there just for fun, right? And it was like the perfect storm. You know, it was the perfect storm of, oh my God, I have this and this and this and this. And literally, I was at a farmer's market one day and I was waiting for all these freelance checks to come in. And by the way, when you're working as a freelancer, those checks take a long time to come in, sometimes 6 months. The cost of health insurance back then, we have Obamacare now, which is still expensive, but back then I was paying $2,400 a month to insure my children and me on COBRA. There was a job loss in there, and suddenly I'm at the farmer's market and I'm trying to buy some apples, and I just say to myself, oh, let me just check Citibank to make sure I have enough cash to cover these apples. I had $18 in my bank account. The apples were going to cost six. And I thought, I cannot spend one third of my wealth at the time on these apples. I mean, that was the nadir, right? I mean, I guess there were other nadirs. Like one other nadir was, so after I got the hysterectomy, they didn't take out the cervix, which they should have. Again, women's healthcare myths and wrong turns and bad advice. So I was told to keep the cervix in because it played a role in sexual pleasure. Well, that turned out to be bunk. So 5 years later, that cervix gets sick. It has precancer of the cervix. I have to get that cervix out. I come home from the hospital. Things are not right. Things are not right. Something's going on. I can tell I am not well. I go to divorce court to fight my own battle because I'm representing myself because I don't have enough money to hire a lawyer. And I'm at divorce court. I think it was child support that day. And I just was hemorrhaging and feeling really bad. I go to the hospital. I take myself to the emergency room. They say, oh, we don't have a speculum here to look inside you. Here's some antibiotics. Go home. And then a few days later, my daughter, who's 20 at the time, found me wandering the apartment in a complete daze with a glass Tupperware container, putting giant blood clots that were falling out of me all over the apartment into this glass container because I wasn't sure what they were and maybe I needed them. And then she says, we need to take an ambulance. We need to call 911. I said, don't you dare. I can't afford that extra $4,000 to $10,000 that it may cost. I don't know. You never know how much those ambulances are going to cost. So we took Uber pool to the emergency room. I mean, just think about this. This is America circa, this was 2017. That daughter's now in med school and trying to change this from within. But at the time, I mean, you know, nothing's changed now. I guess Jill Biden just got, you know, some money to address women's health, which thank goodness. But it's like the tiniest small step in a giant, giant mountain that we are pushing that Sisyphean rock up over and over again and falling back down. That was a long answer to your question. I'm
no,
sorry.
No,
that is the truth. Yeah.
And it's a story that we hear from people time and time again, that women are either ignored or we ignore our own symptoms because, oh, it can't be that bad. We're fine. Or financially, we can't afford it. And the healthcare system is just not catching up. And it's great that we have this research money coming in, but where is it going to be allocated is my question. I want to make sure that it's like I have any control over it. I hope that, yes, I'm going to tell Jill. I'm going to call Jill later.
Me too.
But I hope that it's allocated in the proper places because your story is horrible, but not unique. Like horrible for you, obviously, but not unique in stories that we have heard. And I think one of the strangest things that stuck in my mind was the fact that one of the reviews of your book, I think it was New York Times, talks about how it might be, you know, the blood might be a little too much if you want to skip the first chapter. Why? Because you don't want to face it? I mean, what was the, how did you respond to that?
I cried. It was like everything that I was discussing in that book was right there in that New York Times review. And I also couldn't believe it was written by a woman that worked in a section of the paper that's no longer there. It was a women's email. You know, it was went out to women and it was about women's events and women's issues. And it just seemed so tone deaf. It also seemed like she hadn't read the whole book, frankly. I mean, it just was like she read chapter one and two and decided that she didn't like it and didn't read the rest. I don't know what to say about that other than it made me cry and it made me feel hopeless.
It makes me angry.
You know, it made me angry too, but more sad than angry. I try not to get angry anymore because the anger will eat us up from inside. And I turn that anger into writing.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, and you said you had a picture of it like in the book, and I'm like, I welcome that photo. I want women to know if this is happening to you and
run
and other people. I want them to know what to do. And you know, you also talk about the misinformation that you were given about needing your cervix and that you needed it for sexual pleasure. And, you know, and we've talked to a lot of the women in your book that you talked to, like we've had Rachel Rubin on the podcast.
Yeah, I love her.
And NeuroTrack. We've had Ellie, is that right?
Ellie's great.
Yes.
That's so funny.
Had her on as well.
And just completely like by coincidence?
Just coincidental.
Oh, yeah, we had her on. We had, it was her December. She was in December.
She was on December and we were talking about their cognitive health scan that they have now for a doctor's appointment.
Worked with her as well. And so it's just, it's really, it's a small little circle. It's so crazy when you get into this space, how you talk to each other and all of you all are fighting the good fight. That's what I'm like.
Well, here's what worries me about that, though. Yes, we're all fighting the good fight. We're talking to each other. We all know each other. How can we get the fight beyond our own walls? That's really what is at issue here. And when, you know, going back to that New York Times review, when the New York Times dismisses my blood as gross, literally gross, then we're keeping it in the same little circle, right? And one of the best parts of writing this book, the really, truly best parts, I get a lot of beautiful emails from women. And despite how my story is my story, they all say, you've told my story. I mean, the specificity of my story made them feel that I had told their specific story. But what's amazing is the men who write me and say some version of, I had no idea. I had no idea. And if I could just get this book into the hands of men,
yes,
our allies would be the dream scenario. But, you know, 80% of books are bought by women. So, you know, whatever.
Another part of the book that I found really interesting is the talk you have about mentorship and how important it is for women of our demographic to mentor younger women. And you use the example of Nora Ephron for you. Can you tell that story?
Well, first of all, let me say that before I was a writer and journalist, I was a photojournalist, and I found very few female mentors in that field just because there weren't any
females in that field, except at the time, my friend Alexandra Avakian and I, and we were buddies, but there just weren't women in the field back then. So after I wrote Shutter Babe, which, by the way, I wanted to call either News Whore or Shutter Girl. I didn't want Shutter Babe because the whole book is about not being the object, like objectifying the men. And then suddenly this title is placed on me. Anyway, that's just another story. After Shutter Babe came out, Nora Ephron, my hero, my absolute hero, called me on my home phone back before cell phones. Remember home phones? I don't know if you guys look young, but anyway.
Oh, no, we're your age. Okay. We're your age.
Wrap that cord around my finger. Yeah.
Okay. So Nora found my home phone through my friend Meg, I think. And she said, "Hi, this is Nora. Is this Deb?" And I said, "Yes, come on, Meg, stop pulling my leg." You know, I thought it was my friend Meg because I knew that she knew her. And she goes, "No, this is Nora. And I just wanted to say, I really liked your book, Shutter Babe. And I'd love to take you out to lunch."
And we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. And we're back.
I was speechless. I was like, what? Lunch? You know, just completely. I've met many celebrities in my day, but none of, you know, I don't get nervous around them. But Nora Ephron really is just the woman I've looked up to my whole life. If you know, when those questions, when they ask you, who would you have at your dinner party? She's the one that I would have at my dinner party. And then I got to have her at my dinner parties. And that was amazing because she created around her, there's a word in Russian called tusovka, which is like your group around you. It's like you have your tusovka in the kitchen. It's who do you have in your home, basically. And her tusovka, for lack of a better American word, were women and men of all ages. And she would invite us to her house and she would have dinner parties for 20 and everybody would have a name card. Are there two giant round tables? Because she didn't believe in square tables or rectangular tables. So two giant round tables with your name tag. And then you had to, at dessert, move to another table and sit next to somebody else. And then there were games afterwards. And so it was either charades or running charades or mafia. And in these games, you really got to know people. You got to see them not as sort of, you know, the celebrities that you see on screen, but as real humans who want to like win at running charades. And more than that, she would take me out for monthly and sometimes, you know, bi-monthly lunches. And it was during these lunches that I was working out. And I think she could tell that something was going on in my marriage. And she was helping me work out and get to the point of acceptance that divorce is not as bad as I thought it would be. I had to get out of that situation. I had to get my uterus out. I mean, she was this maternal figure that I don't have in New York. My mom lives in DC and she really served that role. And she had two boys. She didn't have any daughters. She was like me, the eldest of four daughters. So we had a lot in common. We were even, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but we were both cheerleaders on our cheerleading squads back in our public high school. We just gelled and she changed my life. And when I say changed my life, she introduced me to people. She helped me edit op-eds that I was writing. I wrote a book review for the New York Times. She helped me edit. She would just be like, I would send her an email saying, "Hey, what do you think of this?" And she would send back some notes. And who does that, right? She's a busy woman. But I wasn't the only one that she did this to. She had Lena Dunham was one of her mentees, and Rebecca Traister, who's a really wonderful journalist as well, Meg Wolitzer. She just had all these mentees. And I think for her, I mean, in retrospect, she knew she was dying, right? She knew she had this cancer, and maybe that's in the end result what she wanted her legacy to be, to sort of place this love all over and let these women know that she cared about them, that she was thinking about them, that she wanted them to succeed. And also that as important as success is bringing people around you, having that dinner, making the space for social life. She was as good at that as she was at doing the work.
You know, in your book, you also, something that really stuck with me was your father saying about not doing things that's blood money. Can you share a little bit about that and how, gosh, that's so hard to do in this time, the things that presented yourself or were presented to you and you were really trying not to use blood money. Can you share that?
So that began, and I remember this so well. I must have been 4 or 5 years old, and my dad was just starting at this law firm after going to law school. Like, I was born when my dad was in law school, so they were struggling, right? So he was in law school, and then he was a White House fellow for a year with under President Johnson. And then he joined this very white shoe law firm called Covington and Burling. And one of the first cases they gave to him was a tobacco case, and he would have been taking the role of fighting for the tobacco company. And he came home, and I remember he was teary about it, and he said, I can't do this. And he said, you know, what would you guys think if I lost my job over this? And I think my mom was like, you've got to do what you got to do, right? And so he refused to take the tobacco case. He just refused. He said, I cannot play a part of causing cancer in other people. And so I think as sort of a challenge, they gave him this, and they were mad at him. They gave him a pro bono case that they thought he would just fail at miserably. It was going up against the U.S. Navy. And the U.S. Navy was bombing the island of Culebra off the coast of Puerto Rico. And people lived there. They were bombing an inhabited island for target practice. And so I guess he took this on pro bono, and he just kept fighting and fighting and fighting. And watching that has affected my life. He eventually got paid a lot of money from the Puerto Rican government and won. And they wanted to erect a statue of him. And I was there at when I was 9 years old, sort of clapping for him on the dais as he had won his case and was telling all the people of Culebra, thank you. And so when I'm sitting in a PR firm, which I had to join, so because I was not only a single parent, I was a solo parent. After my divorce, my ex-husband left, moved across the country. I was on my own, paying tuitions, paying for all the kids, paying for the apartment, you know, no help at that point. And we were working on a drug that would help people who were addicted to opioids. And I remember thinking, so it's come to this. I couldn't handle the distance of that. I really kind of feel like I'd rather live in the street than help the Sackler family get more money, because they could then push out more drugs on more people and get more people addicted because they can finally poop and they're not going to be constipated. I really have a hard time doing things that have nefarious ends.
Well, that should be celebrated, not as a negative. I think that's goes to your character.
It has done terrible things for my bottom line. It's so funny because my partner wrote a Modern Love this weekend. The Daily Mail printed this like fallacious headline saying, you know, top lawyer and his millionaire girlfriend. And I just started laughing. I was like, if only you knew that I one time very recently had $18 and I couldn't buy a bag of apples. Like, I mean, the book is a way of explaining how is it that I have had that, what you said at the beginning, this sort of, I'm a New York Times bestselling author. I've written for Emily in Paris. I have all these things that you would think on a resume would allow me a very comfortable life. I feel like I'm struggling every day. I'm 57 years old and I'm like, can I breathe this month? Can I pay my rent this month? I don't own anything. I have no assets, you know, but I also have my integrity. So it's a trade-off, right?
Not always an easy trade-off though. And I think you also talk about the fact that, you know, at one time you were holding like 4 different jobs, and that stress can affect your health, and that you feel like a lot of the illnesses that you had could have been factored in because of stress. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, what's interesting is I think that it was a combination of stress and menopause, and nobody was saying to me, hey, you might be in menopause, because I'd had my uterus out so early that I didn't know when I was in menopause. But a lot of that sleeplessness and a lot of that, all that, I was going to say a bad word on air, but I'm going to say it, like, you know, stuff. Bad work for stuff. All that stuff that was going on was, I'm now positive, was a combination of regular old stress and menopause. And, you know, if only somebody had told me when I got my uterus out, hey, you might want to go on estrogen, I think I could have avoided a lot. Like, a perfect example is I was getting these terrible migraine headaches starting after my uterus came out. And I went to a neurologist and I said, hey, you know, I had really bad headaches as a kid. And then I went through puberty and I got my period and I stopped having headaches. And so we just sort of forgot about it. And now I don't have my period anymore and I'm getting headaches. Could this be related to hormones? And she laughed at me. She laughed at me. She goes, like one of those, like, no, sorry, we don't have any evidence of that. I was like, well, has anybody studied it? And she said, we have no evidence of it. In this very like haughty way, I was like, well, I will be going to a new doctor.
Yeah.
And I actually went to a male doctor who's like, yeah, we think it could be, but we don't have any studies.
And they probably do have, well, I don't know about the ones with the migraines, but there's a lot more. Or studies that are, we're finding out, which Colleen and I have found from doing the podcast. We didn't know this until we did the podcast about how little gynecologists are educated in menopause. Like,
no, in med school. Yeah, in med school.
I wrote about that in Two Lady Parts too. No, it's crazy. And in fact, when I dropped off my daughter at med school that first day, I said, learn about menopause, do everything you can. And if you don't learn about it, call me. I want to know about that. Because I want to report that. And she said, actually, University of Buffalo has an amazing program. And she learned a lot. And she's actually going into family medicine. And which that knowledge will be very useful.
The whole thing with women's health, the misinformation out there is so frightening and so behind. And you address this in your book too, the amount of time women wait in an emergency room. I mean, look what happened to you.
It's crazy. It's just crazy. I was there all day. I was a single parent, solo parent. I had to get home to my kid. I gave up after 8 hours of being there. You know, we don't have a speculum. Here's some antibiotics, you know. And then I went home to die. Had my daughter not found me, I would have been dead. So I'm wearing hearing aids under here because I lost my hearing to COVID. And there was a simple operation called a balloon eustachian tube dilation surgery that I was scheduled to have. I went to the hospital. I'm off. My doctor scrubbed in. They have the line in my hand, you know, when they put the little, you know, line for the anesthesia. And my doctor, my surgeon comes in at the last minute, almost in tears. And he's like, they denied coverage for this operation. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, United Healthcare denied coverage for this surgery. And I said, well, how much does it cost? He said, well, give or take, probably around 40 grand. I was like, bye.
It's just things like this that happen all the time that put women, particularly women, it happens to men too, but they puts women in these positions where they can't pull ahead. Just like you said, you just feel like you're swimming upstream.
You're swimming upstream. And, you know, I look at, for example, I lived in Paris from 1988 to 92. And I never paid a healthcare bill. I never paid a doctor bill there. And I look at my friend Marion, who is dealing with breast cancer there. And she has not paid a bill. You know, she goes for radiation and chemo and all these things. And it's just like, she's not worrying about the money. She's worrying about staying alive, right? That's what you should be worrying about. But when I got stage zero breast cancer, which they don't even call breast cancer anymore, so I feel bad even calling it breast cancer, but DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, which is a tiny little lump that has cancerous cells in it. When I got that, I didn't have enough money to do the follow-up to make sure that the lump was gone. I had to go, initially when I felt something there, I had to go to the Harlem Breast Center because I didn't have insurance. So I had to get like a free mammogram, which weren't, you know, now it's easier to get a free mammogram. Back then it wasn't. But just all these, there's all these barriers to women's health. Not to mention, you know, this adenomyosis I was talking about earlier that took 16 years to diagnose. Why wasn't anyone asking me, like, well, how are your periods? Are they bad? Are they really bad? And why did it take my family practitioner looking at my blood and finding that my hemoglobin was a 7, which is like you're barely standing at a 7, to say, huh, what's going on here? He had the test redone because he couldn't believe it was so low. And then we started asking the questions about what was going on. And we found that I had this, you know, my uterus was like this big when they finally took it out, full of disease.
Another thing you said was, how would you know what was normal?
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned that in the book. I didn't know what was normal. I thought, you know, what's normal? Because we're not having these conversations with each other about what's a normal period.
What is right. Period? And we weren't, and before I had a Diva cup, because I couldn't wear tampons anymore, because forget it, they were not going to staunch that flow. But before I started wearing a Diva cup and could measure ounce-wise how much was coming out, how much blood was coming out, I had no idea. And so when I say, oh, I'm producing an ounce of blood every half hour, my doctor's like, what? Because you're only supposed to produce an ounce of blood throughout your whole period.
Wow.
Who knew?
What do you hope in reading the book and in writing the book, what do you hope that women take away from it?
I think the most important thing that a woman could take away from this book is learning how to self-advocate. And I say that having gone through this so many times and finding even my own self, even after writing this book, having a difficult time self-advocating. I was recently with a male urologist who was completely gaslighting me. And I had to put on my lady parts brain and be like, he's lying. He's lying. He's telling me to take a bleach bath. I'm like, I don't think that's good for the vulva.
Yeah.
Like, it hurts.
Maybe for your male patients, but I don't think that's good for my vagina. I'm sorry. Like, and then I went back to my gynecologist. She's like, oh God, no, don't take a bleach bath. But self-advocate. Constantly ask yourself, is this doctor well-trained in the thing that I'm going to him for? Constantly seek a second opinion. Always do research, and don't do kind of crazy Google research. Go to Mayo Clinic. Go to the real websites that give you actual information. Because if you go on the crazy websites, you know what I'm talking about. You're going to be told, like, you know, drink some milk and stand on your head and everything will be gone. No, don't do that. Go to well-established websites that have accurate information. And even when you see that accurate information, question it. I just did an interview with Avram Blooming, who wrote this book called Estrogen Matters. And he takes the Women's Health Initiative to task and says, this data was not read correctly. It was deliberately misinterpreted to say estrogen causes breast cancer. And he said that has caused an entire generation of women to lose out on the benefits of estrogen. My mother's generation lost out. You know, she's 81 years old. She was taken off estrogen. She lost out.
Thank you so much, Deb, for coming on the show today. We appreciate
Thank
it.
You. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Deborah Kopaykin, for being on our show today and sharing your stories that led you to write Lady Parts, sharing this conversation with us and how to be your advocate. These are issues that can easily happen to all of us. And, you know, it could be something minor, it could be something major, but we have got to be your own advocate. Follow us on all social media accounts, TikTok, we're on Instagram. We have a wonderful Facebook group. We have these videos on YouTube. And don't forget, April 27th in New York City is Conversations with Prime Women with Mindy Cohn and Colleen Rosenblum and mm-hmm. fabulous guests. Yeah. So go to conversationswithprimewomen.com if you want more information on tickets.
And have a great week, guys. We'll talk to you next time.
Bye.